This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for driving up the hill and driving back down the hill. Thank you in advance. I come here to visit, because I have a brother and nieces and nephews in the Bay Area, but feels like my favorite place in the world. I call the stream there the magic forest. Maybe all forests are magic, but this one in particular. So yeah, it's very nice to be here. I'm going to talk about the triple treasure. Who's heard of the triple treasure? It's a very important kind of framework and practice we do in Buddhism. The triple treasure is the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I'm going to read to you a chant we do at morning service often about the triple treasure. I take refuge in the Buddha, bowing with all beings, acquiring the great way, awakening the unsurpassable mind. I take refuge in the Dharma, bowing with all beings, deeply entering the teaching, wisdom like the sea. I take refuge in the Sangha, bowing with all sentient beings, bringing harmony to all, completely without hindrance. So I'm going to start with the word Buddha, which has kind of multiple meanings. The first meaning is, of course, the historical Buddha. But he wasn't born with the name Buddha. Talk about his life in a second here, but at some point he went to the forest, as was very common in those days for all sorts of spiritual seekers. And after practicing different types of practices, and he decided to sit down under a fig tree and just, I like to think, do the Zazen practice we do. It's what Buddha was doing under that tree. And eventually he had a great awakening. And afterwards he got up and walked away and met some people who kind of said, "Wow, what happened to you?" Like they could see he had something going on. And he said, "Well, gosh, let's just say I woke up. I awoke." And that's the meaning of the word Buddha, the awakened one. So what do we mean by awakened? Obviously we have to sleep at night, but awakening means to be more aware of the present moment. So if you notice how much thinking we do all the time, which is natural, body secretes hormones and gastric juices, the brain secretes thoughts, that's very natural. But the thoughts take us away from the present moment. And a friend told me recently why he started meditating. He goes, "I was just thinking so much about stuff, and I was driving a car, and I almost got in an accident. I thought, I better learn to pay attention. So he researched how to learn to pay attention, and he came across Zen Buddhism. Kanagari Roshi used to say mindfulness is like turning on a switch. Or he said it was like turning on the TV. It's kind of funny. Does this mean you make a decision to pay attention? And, you know, all this happens very, very fast. It doesn't last long because that's the nature of things. But I like, and our obsessions, our constant thinking doesn't go away, but just like both are happening, we're aware of the present moment and we're thinking. And to some extent, it's kind of like the spotlights on
thinking. See, I don't think it's that.
Spotlights on thinking and the periphery is what's going on in the present moment. So we just kind of switch that. Spotlights on our body, what's going on around us. One great thing about mindfulness is when someone's talking to us, how about we listen? Instead of spending so much time thinking about what we want to say. It's a very practical example. So we kind of switch the spotlight. The thinking's still going on, but it's more peripheral. We're interested in the present moment. So there's Buddha, who's a historical person who lived, and luckily we have a lot of his teachings. There was a big oral tradition at the time, and people memorized his teachings. But another aspect of Buddha, well, what he wanted to teach is we can also do this. So the chant said, acquiring the great way. So the Buddha laid down instructions for how we can wake up. He had an Eightfold Noble Path, but sometimes that's summarized as three things. One is understanding. So understanding is Dharma, which I'll get to. What's the truth? How do things work? Let's read, let's discuss, let's look at our understanding of the world. The other thing is kind of ethics. We call them precepts. Are we saying things that are conducive to harmony? What are we saying? What are we doing? What's actually going on in our life? I relate that to Sangha, community. And then the third part is our state of mind, which is mindfulness, kind of going beyond thinking to just awareness. And I equate that to Buddha. So the story of the Buddha is his father, the king, was... It was prophesied, it's like, you know, your son's either going to grow up to be a great king or wander off to the forest and be a holy person. And the father's like, oh, I know what I want. So let me assure him that he'll be happy being a king. So he lived a shelter, very sheltered, pampered. Well, he trained in martial arts and stuff, but I think he wasn't allowed to leave the compound because his father thought, it turns out rightfully so, if he's out in the world, he's going to start questioning things. Well, like any young person, he wanted to get out of the house. So he, behind his father's back, he got the charioteer to take him out. This is kind of a famous story. He went out and saw somebody who was sick, and he goes, wow, I've never seen somebody that sick. somebody who was very old. He was like, oh, wow, that's a shock. He saw a corpse. That was a big shock. And then he saw one of these thousands of holy people who kind of dedicated themselves to renunciation and waking up. And he was so deeply moved, he goes, yeah, I'm going to go to the forest and see more deeply, not just for his own suffering, but for the human condition. He's like, this is really intense. I think you'd agree that being sick, and we don't know about being old yet, but being dead, having our people die is intense. Well, it occurs to me our life's kind of like the Buddha's life. When people are old and sick, we put them away in institutions. Actually, that's why I'm out here. My brother has dementia, and I visit him in a nursing home. And we're definitely protected from death. You know, they have to hurry up and suddenly somebody becomes a corpse and they're like, get them out of here. I don't want to deal with this. So we're very sheltered in a way. And I also think in the history of humanity, we're all kind of like royalty. We've got infinite entertainment at the touch of our fingers. We've got infinite variety of food. We're like, wow, this is kind of like what the Buddha experienced. So the second aspect, besides the historical Buddha, he laid out that we can awaken. So then we actually say, well, we try not to say too much. Well, no, we say, but it seems a little hard to say out loud. We say, I am Buddha, but the important part is you are Buddha. So once somebody said to me, oh, I love Buddhism. The Dalai Lama is just so amazing. I just love Buddhism. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, the Dalai Lama is amazing. You know, we should read his books. But what struck me, I thought, wait a minute. Buddhism's not about the Dalai Lama. Buddhism is about you. What are you doing? Are you awakening? So that's that's kind of a substantial belief if we take it on. Now we say, oh, okay, so I have the potential in the future to awaken if I practice. And like, sure, that's great, but tomorrow never comes. So one thing we emphasize in our school of Buddhism is we are already awake. We just haven't been paying attention. We do say acquiring the great way, but that acquiring is kind of the path that we can own. But the path is something you do in the present moment. And another aspect, we use the word Buddha for. So Buddha, when he had his awakening, he says, I have awakened with the whole world. The whole world has awakened. So this sounds philosophical, but it's actually kind of practical. We believe everything is Buddha. Not just humans. All living creatures and, well, inanimate objects. Everything's Buddha. So, because what Buddha awakened to is kind of the inseparability, the oneness of everything. So it makes sense when the system is a whole, the whole has awakened. But one more thing I want to say about seeing ourselves as Buddha is You know, when you see a Buddha statue, and many, many people who aren't Buddhists at all, they're just like, oh, I like a Buddha statue. You know, humans just feel something. And sometimes we want the Buddha statue just out in the garden. You know? But when I see a Buddha statue, I think, wow, that's a good idea. Like, maybe I can be like that Buddha statue. You know, just settled, upright, meditating. So Buddha statues are very helpful that way. So Buddha has these multiple meanings. Any, I'll take some questions now and then at the end. Any comments about what I said about Buddha? The word Dharma. Dharma means truth, and then in the traditional sense, Dharma is what the Buddha taught, the words of the Buddha. So that's kind of the surface meaning of Dharma. But if Dharma is truth, then everything is Dharma, because anything that exists, it exists. It's the truth. It's here. So even lying and delusions and craziness, you go, oh, that's not the truth, but it's happening. It's what's happening. And people are super influenced by lies and faults. Narratives, you know, if somebody's angry with you, you might say, oh yeah, you're just deluded. But you need to pay attention to how to react to the person in their delusion. So, from that point of view, everything is done. And then Sangha traditionally was the community of Buddhist practitioners, monks, nuns, lay women practitioners, lay men practitioners. So practitioners were considered, that's Sangha. And so if we're interested in this path, it's, well, some people, gosh, especially with the internet now, they just sit on their couch and you can pull up thousands of different Buddhist teachers. But actually seeing people in person and talking to people and hanging out with people and deciding to do a project together. You know, humans are incredibly wired to be affected by the people around us. So we have a choice in some ways to spend time with people that are more helpful, wholesome, or not. That's our choice, but Sangha is very supportive. But there's another aspect of Sangha which is really interesting, is we're hanging out with people, doing stuff together, and somehow our buttons get pushed. It's like, so in the Buddha's teaching, you know, everyone, I respect everyone, unconditional love type thing, and then, oh, this one person is just so hard to, oh, that is so good for us, so good. Wake up to how our mind is working, how our body is working. So even though it's difficult, this is the practice of sharing our life with others. So from that point of view, I expand this again to everybody is Sangha. And once again, not just humans. Once again, inanimate, it's all Sangha. So I was presenting this, one of my students said, she said, wait a minute, you just said everything's Buddha, everything's Dharma, everything's Sangha. Doesn't that just kind of make these words meaningless? But I hope from what I've said, you don't think of them as meaningless words. Oh, yeah, under Dharma, we say deeply entering the teaching wisdom like the sea. So Buddhist teaching, sometimes I think there's two very important points that we think we might already know, but one of them is called impermanence. Everything changes. But that's pretty hard for us because the things we like change. The things we don't like don't change as fast as we hope, but they're still changing. If you can see enough. So this, sometimes people think of permanence that it's kind of bad news. People we love die. But this radical impermanence, that everything is changing very quickly, kind of makes everything special because it's new. One example is we put live flowers on the altar. We don't put plastic flowers on the altar because it's living and we take care of it. You can keep flowers going pretty long if you change the water and trim the stems. So impermanence is kind of the newness, the freshness. And it's really related to being present. This is a new moment. Doing this practice, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, I think he tells us to say, present moment, wonderful moment. Because if we're paying attention, I find ordinary things like plants and buildings and clouds are like, wow. That's pretty beautiful. And then I call it oneness. Everything's interconnected. It's a huge teaching. So, well, it turns out science finding out part of our brain really looks at separateness, and separateness is good up to a point. This is my toothbrush. It's not your toothbrush. You know, please don't use it. So there's kind of a organic, natural separateness, healthy boundaries. But if all you know is separateness, you know, fighting, arguing, loneliness, kind of a... So oneness is a huge help if you can, without pushing separateness away, expand your thinking, your awareness to emphasize oneness. You know, and then, you know, your way of thinking slightly change, the vibes you're putting out in the world change if you're interested in oneness. So we say deeply entering the teaching, there's infinite, we're heading towards an infinite number of books about Buddhism. But if you study for a while, you start to go, wait, they're all saying the same thing. Slightly different styles, slightly different flavors, but because once I was talking to a teacher complaining about my life, and he goes, things are going to change. And I go, they are? Really? Certain things change? You know, I'm studying Buddhism for a while, but we forget. So we keep returning because it's very hard for us to let these teachings penetrate. Yes, there's impermanence, and yes, there's oneness. Then we say wisdom like the sea. I live in Colorado, but it's when I'm out here, I really have to go hang out in the ocean. The ocean. One of my relatives was having trouble. I said, man, get yourself down to the ocean. Spend a day walking out, go have a, you know, whatever, a few hours, just soaking up the vibes from the ocean. So I've scheduled on my way to the airport. I'm going to take some time to go to the ocean. And Sangha, so we say, bringing harmony to all. Completely without hindrance. Well, I don't know. Buddhism kind of shocks us by making seemingly impossible statements. That we can completely, without hindrance, sounds like it's easy. But it inspires us. Okay, I'm going to practice bringing harmony to all. And it's, we notice it's not that easy. So this practice, I think one problem is we read about this practice, we read about the teaching, we're like, wow, you know, I'm gonna become a better person. Maybe I'll be more. And that's a little dangerous thinking. You know, we wake up to things as they are, and any idea of perfection is just not a good thing to do to ourselves. You know, we should accept and respect and have compassion for ourselves. No matter what our judgmental mind is telling us. Okay, I'm going to look at the clock. Oh, talked a lot. funny, I tend to do that. So, any questions? Yes.
I had maybe a, so thanks for the talk. I had a, maybe a simple question, which is, what is the wheel of Dharma? What does it symbolize?
So the...
Would you repeat the question?
The question is, what is the wheel of Dharma? And what does the wheel of Dharma symbolize? And sometimes we say our practice is turning the wheel. So the wheel's a great thing because... what makes a wheel actually a wheel is when it's turning. So that's part of impermanence. Everything's active. Sometimes I say we live in a world of verbs, but unfortunately our mind thinks it's a world of nouns. But the turning is, the teaching is active. The teaching is... So thinking, studying, talking about dharmas, called turning the wheel.
Thanks for the talk, Jodo. I appreciated the reminder to pay attention, and especially to pay attention to someone you might be in relationship with where that's a difficult relationship. Can you share how you continue to pay attention even when the feeling to turn away or ignore might be really strong?
Well, because I'm a human, I...
Also, would you repeat the question?
Oh, the question is, how do you pay it, and tell me if I can get this right. How do you pay attention in a relationship when things are difficult? And how do you avoid turning away and avoiding? Well, I'm pretty good at turning away and avoiding, but so I have an intention to be there for the person. I kind of wake up to how natural differences are. Okay, we're all, we all don't get along because we've all had very different life experiences. Growing up, but even twins have kind of have different life experiences because your experiences kind of mold your nervous system into that's what life's about. The way I am. Well, we don't even see that's the way we are. We think, oh, this is the way things should be. My nervous system deeply says, oh, no, this should be different. But so we understand what's going on. We understand it's natural to have negative emotion. It's natural to disagree. And so from that bigger perspective, it's like... We can work with it. So even Thich Nhat Hanh said, he needs to talk to somebody, but if things get too upsetting, he temporarily goes outside and calms himself down before he engages. I find as much as a another line from a song. I don't hate nothing at all except hatred. I think those good-hearted people end up falling in that trap. So, we know we have to work with what's going on. And it's an excellent opportunity. So the famous Zen teachers always said, oh, that's not a problem. That's an opportunity. And then I say, oh, another gosh darn learning experience. But it's true. We can learn. Another question? Okay, you're asking about emptiness and reality?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's a big concept, but...
What?
It's a big concept in Buddhism, but I just want to get your opinion on how do you, one hand they say it's emptiness, and the other hand that reality is different, so how do you...
Okay. The question is, what is emptiness and how does it work? Time. That's my empty watch. Oh boy. Well, it's really impermanence, and it's kind of a confusing word. Some people say they want to change the word emptiness to boundless. And the Heart Sutra we chanted, a lot of people have trouble. So it really is about impermanence. So we have an experience and we cling to it. is a terrible example, but it's like funny. One spouse said to the other, "I can't believe you farted in front of my parents 6 years ago." Like, you know, let it go. No eyes, no ears, no nose.
No fart.
No. So, yeah, that's my example of that.
So, I have a question.
Yeah.
So the mantra that we read today says there's nothing. Everything is empty. Nothing. Nothingness, right? Does that mean we're all in a matrix?
Well, that's fine. The matrix probably was pretty powerful. Oh, the question is, if there's emptiness, are we all in nothingness? And it's just a matrix-like
movie. Nothing is real. You're, I don't know, we're in a matrix illusion.
So in Zen we say both are true. And yet this is a huge, at the same, and then the Zen teaching is really based on paradox. There's an incredible paradox, like, we don't want to die, and we're going to. Our whole life is kind of based on paradox. Like, well, I want my share, but I'm going to share. You know, it's just how do we balance these paradoxes? We wake up to them, and we kind of see that, yeah, there's these multiple aspects. So the teaching of emptiness is letting go. It's kind of a medicine. So Buddhist teaching, it's said to be a medicine, where we have this illness of being asleep, this illness of some unwholesome habits. How do we take the medicine? But like with medicine, you take the right amount. Like, oh, it's good for me, I think I'll. So it's something called, sometimes I haven't heard this for a while, called Zen sickness.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.